Okay, I think we're about to get started, but I'm just waiting for my wave from behind to tell me that everything is ready to go. Should be 5:15. Otherwise, my clock is front. All right. Cool. I got a thumbs up, so that must be good. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the last session of day two. I want to take this opportunity to thank you for coming. I'm surprised to see so many of you. I'm thrilled. I want to also take this opportunity to be one of the many Microsoft employees that get to say, "Welcome to Microsoft Campus." We're really excited to have you here, and we're really glad that this is happening in Redmond. I think it's a great opportunity for us to have the team that actually does the coding very close to you and have that conversation going. I have a few folks from my team right in the back, and they're going to help me out with Q&A today. And we can continue the conversation tomorrow in at the booth of Visual Studio, or just come find us around. I think that today that this build's focus is really less about announcing technology like we did 1 year ago, and more about kind of cementing this technology and starting talking about building apps. So this is really what I want to focus on. This talk is about building apps and specifically using C++. And when you do that, specifically when you target Windows Store, you end up having to deal with C++, CX, and WinRT. And now with the big announcements that we had yesterday with Windows Phone, joining the native frenzy and the WinRT fiesta, if you may, there is even more reason to have this conversation. And I think a lot of the things that we're talking today in this talk apply to all the platforms. So my name is Marian Lopareau, and really quick, I've been spending the past 3 years working on the programming model for WinRT and C++, working both on the library side, on WRL, and on C++ CX, both library and front end. And in today's talk, I'm going to go through some of the interesting challenges that C++ CX developers, if you want to call them like that, C++ developers that target the Windows Store run into. And I'm splitting that into correctness issues and performance issues. At the end, we're going to have a quick demo. I'm going to go in the IDE and write a few lines of code and show you a bunch of tips and tricks. But before we jump into that, I really wanted to kind of go back 1 year at the build 2011 when we announced C++ CX and go through the principles that we lined up at the time and really quick describe them. So one of the core things when we started designing C++ CX and how we ended up with C++ CX was the fact that we wanted to give you the power of WinRT, and we didn't want to give any compromises. So, for example, we also provide you with consumption of WinRT APIs, but also authoring of new WinRT APIs. And this was really important. We wanted to give you every customizability that WinRT allows you today. We didn't want to have any excuse of, "Oh, the C++ syntax specifically doesn't allow you to do that." And coming back to that, our main goal was also, once we differentiated the differences, the specific differences between WinRT and C++, we teased them out, and everything else aligns with the current C++ constructs that we have, and you get the familiarity that you get every day in C++ coding. So as soon as we kind of acknowledge that ref counting is different than the way lifetime management is dealt with in C++ today, and the ref classes are different than classes, a lot of the stuff came together, and we were able to provide you, for example, when you write a ref class, the syntax to actually define a constructor is the same one as the syntax for defining a C++ constructor. The same is true for statics. And probably the most important thing is how we deal with exceptions in C++. And providing the ability to to create components that think and dance as components that handle exceptions. And this is different how WinRT was designed, because WinRT, as you, some of you may know, is a COM-based system, and it deals with H results. So it, this was a big shift. And getting to the last principle, once we made that change, and obviously there's got to be some transformation layer between WinRT APIs at the API boundary and what we actually end up providing to C++ developers, there was a lot of things that we didn't feel valuable that you need to know about WinRT specifically when you write WinRT code. And concepts like default interface, you don't always need to know how that specifically needs to be wired up behind the scenes for you. Again, hResults is a great example. Or in general, any method call actually behind the scenes will have a query interface to some other interface potentially. That's code that you always need to write if you were to write directly at hResult level. So why bother? Why spend the time writing boilerplate code when we can delegate that easily to a compiler? And I guess the most important thing is once we do that, we actually, you're focused on the task at hand. You're focused on the things that you want to do in your C++ app. All right. So as we're going to move to the actual meat of the talk, I wanted to say that you can take it as a story, and each story has a hero. So the hero is just a random app. An app that it's pretty good today, and it's about to get published on the Windows Store, but it has a few challenges, like the fact that sometimes it's unstable, and sometimes it lacks responsiveness. It's probably using too much memory as it should be, but as we take it to the story, it'll actually prevail and it'll come as a better app. So it will not be best, because that's kind of the part where this author needs to throw in its creativity and make it a best app on the App Store. But it's definitely going to be better. And I hope to some extent you identify with kind of that app that I'm going to be talking about. Certainly, I specifically picked the topics that I'm going to be talking today, kind of make sure that applies to any C++ app that you end up writing for App Store. So the talk will be split in two. It's, we're going to talk about correctness, and then I'm going to talk about performance. And one thing that we need to talk about correctness is a specific topic are the exceptions and why it is important. As I mentioned earlier, WinRT really doesn't have an exception concept. It is based on hResults. And as a result of that, C++CX creates this wrapping code that actually allows us as developers to deal with exceptions, to handle exceptions. And when you create this model, you have a fixed mapping of hResults that map to a specific set of exceptions. The rest of them are one single type called COMException. And there are some interesting things that are worth calling out. So these are the three types of exceptions that you need to think about when you write C++ apps in App Store. The first one is the WinRT C++ exception. There are C++ exceptions, just like any other ones. But really, the only state information they have is the hResult. And we have a great hierarchy of that. They're all derived from platform exception. You should always focus on using those when you want to communicate outside the boundary, when you communicate with a different language, or a different, like XAML, like a JScript, like a C#. That's when you should use WinRT. That's the only way you can communicate failures from your component up the chain. The reason for that is that, again, we only carry the state of hResult, which is the only thing that can travel across exception, across a boundary. And there is one exception, but it's a very special case. And you see here in the code that I have, I actually provide a string. This is a direct communication with the debugger. It is not something that travels across the API. It gets passed on to the debugger. And it's really useful to use it, because this gives an indication to whoever debugs your component as a consumer what really happened. You want to definitely give more information than an e-bounds, which is what the out-of-bounds exception in this case will get translated as soon as it leaves the C++ component. Moving on to C++ exceptions, this is the great example of data loss if we actually let a C++ exceptions go out over the ABI as an H result. So one of the quick decision that we had to make was that you in C++, you get to define, you may have your exception hierarchy that you self-define, or you may be using std exception or any other exceptions, or maybe throw strings and so on. When they reach a boundary, if that information that you throw doesn't get transferred, it's data loss. So one of the things that happens, the process comes down. And kind of the key takeaway from this is that you really should handle all C++ exceptions before they go over a WinRT boundary. When I say that, I don't mean do a catch dot dot dot. That's definitely the wrong way of interpreting this. Really, you should, and that's kind of the plain, simple example. You should always catch the exceptions that you expect. That's what you find in every object-oriented programming book. But really, we're also not building apps anymore that are so resilient that they need to survive everything. That we need to shrink wrap them in a CD or a diskette and send it. And even if you go take the computer and throw it in the garbage, you throw water on it, that app should still run. That's not the case anymore. We have channels of updating apps today. And I think it's important to let your application crash such that you have an opportunity to get the data back from the users and understand what the problems are and then resolve them such that you give a better experience later on, rather than what happens in this case if you do catch dot dot dot. You eat a lot of exceptions. You never hear from your app sending you back this information. So you can still have data loss. Your customer still may lose the data. There's no guarantee the application will run once you eat an exception that you never expected to get. And ACH exceptions fall exactly in that bucket as well. If you dereference a pointer or you divide by zero, unless this is something that you like doing and is by design, which is rarely the case, this is not something that you should touch in a Windows Store application. It's probably valid for any other types of application. And this is the kind of thing that you really want to fix as a coding defect once you hear about it. So as I mentioned, there's on the right-hand side, there's the generic guidance. We give on exceptions in general. Always catch the most specific exceptions that you expect on catching, and throwing the most specific exception that that you have. But really, again, it's interesting to talk about from the point of view of H results and how that maps to exceptions. When you catch a COM exception, which is the generic exception that maps to an unknown H result, well, it maps to all known H results. Because the underlying, for example, the failure exception derives from COM exception. But you may be having a catch failure exception specifically for that. Finally, you're going to have a catch COM exception that it's the place where you catch all the H results that are not mapped to a specific exception. Something that we've seen in this hero app that we're talking about, our hero app, is that it's hard to deal with the fact that on the default, you don't know what to do with the exception, because really it's an unexpected exception. You had the cases of your switch case on every H result that you knew you're going to get. What do you do on default? And really the answer is simple. Again, let your app crash. You don't know about it, rethrow the exception. It's as simple as rethrowing the exception. Don't just eat the exception in that case. You may have a chance to come back and say, oh, actually, besides e-bounds, I may get some e-invalid args under some circumstances, so I definitely want to handle that case as well. And when you throw exceptions, really you wanna be polymorphic about it. You wanna take sometimes when you write code, you may still need to call into COM. Not all the APIs that are available in Windows Store apps are WinRT, and those are still H result based. And you get an H result based. The worst thing you could do is start dealing with both programming styles. If I'm calling COM APIs, I'm going to do H result-based programming. And then if I'm calling a WinRT API, I'm going to do exception-based. That's a nightmare that you don't want to approach. So the recommendation is to immediately, as you call a COM API, take that H result, and if it's a failure, throw it. And we usually wrap this in a nice macro, in a nice function that gets inlined for your code if you choose to. And calling create exception actually makes sure that if that specific com API returns an e-fail, rather than throwing a com exception of e-fail, we actually throw a failure exception. And your clients will correctly handle that. All right. So now let's move to a related topic about how to deal with exceptions in async. And one of the things that happens with our little app here, and I'm sure it never happens to any other apps. I don't know if you see this. I had the recording embedded in the PowerPoint, but really, that's all. So this is what you're getting. You do something in the app, and what you get back is this progress ring. Which is the guidelines around it are very well specified, so it's good that you're actually seeing that. The problem is that it never stops. And let's look at the code that makes this happen. Really quick, since this is the first time we see this code, I'll go through it. This is using PPL, and it's a function that returns a task. So with the specific reason that once it's done with all the operations that it has in it, allows additional continuations to be tacked along to consume the content. What it does, it really reads a file from disk, and it makes the content available. And we do that by calling, first of all, getting the file, and then we have a continuation after we're grabbing the file to open the file. Once the opening is done, we create a data reader to read the data. And then finally, when loading, we request the loading of all the data, basically the whole file in memory, and then we read it in the last continuations, in the last continuation. This is using PPL. You could do this using the raw async APIs, but you definitely don't want to do that. This is a lot simpler. It allows you to have more linear code, and it makes a lot of use of C++ 11 features like Lambda, so we like that a lot. How many of you are familiar with PPL? Just a quick show of hands. Half the audience. I will definitely recommend for whoever is not familiar to definitely check it out as you start writing the Windows Store apps. And it's actually not specific to Windows Store apps. PPL is available for any async programming that you essentially do in C++. And it provides several enhancements on top of the async operations that are part of the standard. So this is what this app does. And really, I'll do some highlighting here. We are stopping the animation while the file is read in memory. The trick is that many of the async operations and many of the continuations here may fail. And what PPL did in this case of this app looked for the first continuation in this chain of continuations that we coded in, that rather than receiving the results of the previous task, receives as a parameter the actual task. So I'll show you later on how the syntax for that looks like. And really, the code of this app is written correctly, because if you go look at the continuations that are happening beyond the scope of this function, whoever consumes this function actually handles the errors that are coming from these APIs. And the application continues to function correctly. But the problem is that this block here, this last continuation with the animation, executing the animation end, does not execute, gets skipped. So really, you kind of feel like the exceptions is an unrolling stack, and it's similar to how you would write synchronous code and how it unwinds the stack and stop executing the rest of your code. So it's kind of similar here. So let's get the picture out of the way and focus on this last lambda. How do we make it always call? Like I said, it needs to receive, rather than the actual result of the previous call, a task of that. Now, by just making this change, everything will work, and always we're going to enter this method. And we're going to be executing animation end, and we're going to be reading the content. And I skipped it here because it's kind of a few lines of code. But one of the key things that I want to call out is, in case a failure happens now, because we're receiving a task and we are not observing it, and really how we observe it is actually calling the get function of the task to grab the actual results that were received as a parameter, PPL will be upset. And it will say that we didn't handle, so an exception went unobserved. So you do want to call get as well to grab the results of the task. And this is where PPL actually has the opportunity to take that exception that was thrown and give it back to you as a user to handle it. And again, you could actually handle it. In this case, you get an access denied. So it could happen. You don't get access to that file, or maybe it's somewhere it doesn't have to be on disk and something gets denied. You need to handle it. You already have it in your hand. It's an EX variable of access denied head type. What do you do with it? Again, the app was correctly handling the exception later on. So why keeping a hold of it and eating it? Just throw it back again. It's not a bad thing to do. It's not a bad thing to throw exceptions again. And now we made sure that animation end always gets called. This is also a task that always gets called, like the discontinuation always gets called. But we also let the continuations down the line handle correctly the exception moving forward. So that's kind of the correctness things that I wanted to mention. Any questions so far on the specific async code that I showed you? Yes? If an exception gets thrown earlier than that, anywhere in the chain of async operations, if an exception gets thrown, the first task that actually takes a task as a parameter gets called. So it will skip any of the continuations that don't have that signature specifically. So if get file async fails in the first call, all the continuations here will get skipped. All right, so let's move to more interesting stuff. Correctness. Ugh. We always want to get it right, but it's so much work. We're going to stay in async. And why is it useful to talk about async and threading? Because a lot of stuff happens in the background already, and we already heard that all the async APIs that are coming from WinRT always get moved to the background thread. So why do we have to talk about it? And I'll mention it. Yes, there's a question? I'm sorry. All right. If you throw an exception from the async continuation, which is a lambda in this case, the PPL has a wrapper on top of that, and it detects the exception. And someone eventually down the line needs to call get to actually grab the results of that task. And that's when the exception actually gets released and gets thrown. There are multiple places that do that. Basically, when the user does it in the task specifically, or when PPL automatically does it again in another continuation, because it needs to provide the results. For example, if OpenAsync fails, to actually call the next lambda here, needs to give the results. So PPL takes again ownership of the exception. He sees it at the other end. Again, a lot of things can happen in the meantime, like it travel across an ABI boundary as an H result, and it may come back, or maybe it's the same. Everything happens in C++ and is the same exception instance that you're getting. But eventually, this gets handled. OK, so I didn't want to go that fast. But here is the same code. And the only change this time around is that this code executes in an event handler in the UI. So something happens in the UI, an event handler gets called. And the reason why we talk about that is because UI thread is important and is different. It is separate than the background threads, and everything that happens on the UI thread has to do with the UI. All the components that are UI bounded, like XAML or JScript, have to live in that UI thread. And you always need to come back to the UI thread to execute any operations on that UI. Once you do that, it's very tempting to execute a lot more code. And this is what you probably heard a few times, that WinRT is moving to an async-based programming model such that any operations that you call here will forcibly move on the background thread if it lasts more than 50 milliseconds, I believe. But now, let's go through this code and see how PPL schedules it. So first of all, it sees a get file async, which is a WinRT operation, and it creates a small wrapper on top of it for PPL. Then there is a continuation, and for the continuation, there is a task getting created. Then this specific continuation returns an async operation. So again, this gets detected, and a small task wrapper gets tacked along there in this graph. Another continuation, another operation, and finally the last continuation that does the updating of the UI. One of the important things that need to happen here as we do the scheduling is that any of the continuations that have UI operation needs to execute on the UI thread. So PPL takes the conservative approach that once you make an async call to WinRT, you would want to process it results on the UI thread if the call, the scheduling, was done on the UI thread. So let's see how this goes. So the first operation gets scheduled on the background thread. That's what WinRT does. And then a continuation comes back, and it gets executed on the UI thread. We basically now, as part of the continuation, execute another operation. And the end result is that all WinRT operations are executing on the background thread. All your continuations execute on the UI thread. And this is not always desirable. So let's get everything back and discuss a bit about the fact that we want to keep the UI thread with as few T boxes as possible. So how do we do that? Really, if you look at this code, it's only the last continuation that has to execute on the UI thread. Everything else might as well go on the background thread. And it's easy to do that. Again, PPL is conservative in this case, but you know what your Lambda does. So by just specifying the context in which you want your continuation to execute, by saying arbitrary, you tell PPL that it can pick any of the contexts. And it'll always opt for the background threads, obviously. So by just adding these three lines, this will change the way the scheduling works. And the background thread will go. The task will go on the background thread. And the same happens with the other tasks. And finally, the last task, it's actually explicitly called out to use current, but that's the implicit value as well, so you don't need to change it, will go on the UI thread and will correctly execute. If you don't execute any UI thread on the any UI operations on the UI thread, you're actually going to get an exceptions. Those components will be complaining. So correctness is important, but performance as well is something to keep in mind. So it's very easy to go through your code and understand what are the continuations that need to execute on the UI thread and what are the continuations that don't need to be executing there. And one last thing about coming back to the UI thread is that it's not always easy to come back to the UI thread because you may not be in the first place on the UI thread. And you always have this option of storing PPL context around and kind of reusing them. Let's say, what is a case where you wouldn't have access to the UI thread? Let's say that you don't get the event coming from the UI, but it's coming from another component that it's running on the background thread, like a network connectivity component that notifies you of events. Those will not be UI bounded. So those will fire and say, hey, something happened with the network, something happened with your sockets. And the most definitive way to come back to the UI thread in case you need to make notification is using the dispatcher. And this code only looks scary on the slide because I kind of need to fit it in. But really gives you a lot of power and control, and it's very definitive. As opposed to PPL that uses the current context, dispatcher will always go back to the UI thread. And you have the ability to specify priority, and there is also an idle thing that could happen. So it's a very nice way of making sure that your application never never remain unresponsive. All right. Any questions so far? Yes. So the question is, how do you deal with code that requires synchronization? Nothing basically changes on synchronization from a Windows Store app. So as you do continuations, those continuations, you guarantee that they're going to execute one after the other. But if those change data that some other chain of continuations may change, you're left with needing to synchronize the data with critical sections or mutexes or other things that are already available in the Windows platform. All right. The next thing that I want to move to is memory. Was there any other questions? Yes.
So would it be inadvisable then to nest an async call in an async continuation?
nesting it.
So instead of doing a returning the actual async object, you actually just make another one
inside it. So it depends on how you actually write the code. So the question is, to repeat it to the audience, is it unadvisable to nest lambdas in continuations rather than chaining them together? I think it's more simple to reason about chaining them, because you actually can read the code as it was, as a synchronous kind of approach. But I can't think of a significant problem beyond readability. Maybe I'm missing a few. I'm missing something. Let me think about it after the session, and we can chat a bit more. But I mean, it's technically possible, and it works. I wonder if there's any challenges with state and. All right. So before we go to memory allocations, I want to take a quick detour to talk about boundaries. And one of the things that it's important for us, and I'll come back to performance because it ties very well in. An important thing for us is to be able to define in our application, in this nice application that we're talking about, a clear boundary between C++ CX and standard C++ code. And I think I'll mention why is it important for us. And it comes back to performance. I think that's the main reason why everyone should consider having a clear boundary between these two pieces of code. There is obviously an overhead when you write a lot of WinRT classes. So going, for example, to say, hey, actually, WinRT classes allow me to have reference counting, and it's so much simpler to use platform vectors anywhere in my code, and lifetime management is taken care for me. It's easy to fall to that mindset, but that has an overhead, and WinRT has a specific overhead that it's very thin compared with any other cause that you need to pay to go over an ABI boundary. But when you need to call, you need to make C++ to C++ calls, that is much higher. So the recommendation is always just everywhere use C++ when you have a chance. And the only reason why you need to have a WinRT class, when you need to type the words ref space class, is when that an instance of that type needs to go over an ABI boundary. And you know that is going to be a need for it. So for example, it needs to go and talk with XAML, or it needs to go talk with JavaScript or any other languages, or even if you're trying to package it as a third party and someone else needs to consume it, maybe even C++. But there are other ways you could do that as well for C++. A second reason why it's important is portability, and obviously I don't need to talk a lot about it. When you write portable code, you want to have every possible thing in your application logic be packaged well together in a standard C++ code that can compile on multiple platforms, and then you only provide this platform abstraction layer underneath that it would be C++ CX specific in this case. And then last but not least, there's coding style. There's a preference for standard C++ code. And one of the things that we're trying to accommodate with C++ CX is make that possible, allow you to write a lot of C++ code while still being able to target the platform. But let's focus more on performance, and specifically about data conversions. Each time you make a call to WinRT, there's a specific set of WinRT types that you need to pass in. And obviously, there is a high possibility that your data is represented in C++ types. The same is true when you come back from, you make a call to WinRT and you get back data. That will be in the WinRT format, and you may want it in a C++ format. So how do you manage that situation? Of course, a good approach would be to minimize these calls, minimize the chattiness of these APIs. And the less calls you have, the less data needs to travel, the better the performance will be of your application. That is not always easy, especially if you're writing, for example, XAML apps that have a lot of communication back and forth to refresh the UI. So a better approach would be to minimize conversions between these types. So what do I mean by that? When you get data back from WinRT, there is always a way to peek into the data and look at it. If you only need to consume that data, you don't need to translate it to a C++ type to kind of digest the data. The same is true for coming back taking data from C++ and sending it to WinRT. And I'll show you two ways that you can avoid a copy when your buffers go over to WinRT boundary. It's in the next slides. So really, as you keep the data in the originating format, you save a lot of memory copying, and your application will run better. There's less memory churn, and over time, your application can have a better health. Now, how do you achieve that in a how do you get the data in a portable in your portable code? That's somewhat of a challenge, and one of the recommendations that we have is to wrap the data into C++ types and hide it. Hide the WinRT types and kind of provide only access to the data, but you need to manage the lifetime correctly because WinRT types, they're reference counted, and C++ types are not. But really, the best advice is rather than taking a holistic view of your app and try to always follow this, the first two advice, is really to profile your app and figure out where are the bottlenecks, especially if you're, for example, writing a game, you know where the hot loops are. You know that the drawing needs to be as performant as possible. And if you're doing any WinRT calls in that loop, you definitely want to optimize any copies there. There are other areas in your app that you may find it needs performance optimizations. Focus on those. And that's where you should spend your effort optimizing the copies. Because the advice that I have in the future slides don't apply to, you know, plainly apply all this advice to all your code in your application. So let's talk about what the hell am I saying about memory. So here's the a regular code that you'd write. You have a string buffer, char16 or WCHART, and you need to call a WinRT API. What you do is you do a refnew of string, and what this does is it copies the buffer, the data, into a string hat, and that's what gets passed over the boundary. Now, this code here doesn't do a copy. What it really does is takes this buffer data that you have and makes it look like a string hat, really an A string, which is the underlying type in WinRT. And it passes it on to WinRT saying, here's a string. But what's the catch? It cannot be that easy. Otherwise, why wouldn't it have done string reference and we needed to have a string hat in the first place? Really, to use the second piece of code, you need to guarantee that the lifetime of the buffer outlives the call, and then its contents remains unchanged for the duration of the call. Does that sound easy? It is not. The perception may be that, well, it's just the duration of the call. After I'm done with load XML in this code, I can change my buffer to whatever I want, and hey, I actually satisfy the guarantee. But really, the catch is reentrancy. And let's see. You may actually make the call into the WinRT, and it's a string reference, so it gets as an H string. And then this WinRT decides to let everyone know that it got a new string. So it calls all its event handlers that are hooked up to that event, and your code gets called again. And you say, oh, I got a new string. Let me update the buffer. Possibly. I'm oversimplifying it, obviously. This is not as simple, because otherwise we wouldn't have any reentrancy problems. So what happens when we actually set the data in the buffer? Nothing. We're great. Zen. When things go wrong is actually in the WinRT code. Because when everything comes back, you actually broke a fundamental contract that you have with WinRT, that strings are immutable. And really, this is important because if you change all your code to string references today, and 2 weeks from now, you start seeing crashes, weird crashes in your app. And really, they have nothing to do with your code. They have with deep inside the Windows code base. And you start thinking, all those guys at Microsoft, what are they doing with my app? Maybe you should come back and analyze the string reference usage and kind of go deep into guaranteeing that your code is not reentrant, especially when you change specific of those buffers. So that's the catch, reentrancy. And here we have it with a slide with emoticons. That got to stick with you, right? All right, so Next thing is memory, again, arrays is the same story as strings. And here you have a call to a WinRT API that takes an array hat. And to actually populate that array hat, we allocate the data, and then we memory copy from our own buffer. This is the allocation and the copying. And that can be replaced with an array reference. This takes the buffer and makes it look like an array hat to the WinRT API and passes on. Again, the same catch. It may be useful for specific scenarios in your app. I'm giving you kind of the bleeding edge of optimizations in C++ CX. You don't want to use it for everything. All right, any questions so far? So this is for transferring data from C++ to WinRT. And the next slide in the demo is mostly about transferring data from WinRT to C++. Yes?
I have a question regarding memory management. You mentioned something regarding reference counting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now we heard that we don't have to worry about there is reference counting is bad. Now we're going back to reference counting.
So the question is, I mentioned reference counting as a way of managing the lifetime, and .NET really uses garbage collection today. So is there any garbage collection in WinRT? That was the first half of the question, and the other half was is.
Deterministic.
Is there any deterministic destruction in WinRT? And there was also a mention of is reference counting bad, right? That was one of the things.
It used to be bad.
It used to be.
Up until now, I guess.
Well, it's not bad. So okay. I'll answer that really quick. Reference counting is a very simple way of managing lifetime, and it's actually embedding the ref count in it. The object goes away when you lose all references, so that's easy to understand and easy to follow. The only catch with that is cycles. So as opposed to garbage collection, reference counting will not make your cycles, so one object ties to the other one, and they basically hold a reference to each other. Those will not be destroyed ever. So it's in the responsibility of the users, of the developers, to actually catch those cycles and break them such that those objects can be destroyed. So probably in that context, reference counting could be considered bad compared with the garbage collection. But it's actually great because it simplifies things a lot for WinRT. And deterministic destruction is a different topic. Because even in the context of WinRT, there is deterministic destruction that it's different than reference counting. Reference counting will destroy an object deterministically if reference count goes to zero. But it's interesting that sometimes you may have a lot of components taking ownership of your object, but you still want to be destroyed. And that's the concept of deterministic destruction specifically for WinRT. And there is an interface. Basically, in C++ CX, you would expose that by having a public destructor. And calling delete on a hat will deterministically destroy that object, even if the ref count is different than zero. But that's a much deeper topic that could cover a few slides and a few demos. But reference counting is not bad. Thanks for asking. OK, so let's switch to the IDE. And let's talk about buffers. Yes, there's a question.
So in your examples of the lifetime management, they're all synchronous calls. I assume it gets even harder when they're asynchronous. Can you talk about that briefly?
So they were all synchronous call. Actually, so lifetime management is not harder when there are async calls. Because it's very simple. The data will get copied. I should clarify. It gets reference counted. So if it's the same data, and in general in WinRT, as you've seen, strings are immutable, you can have a lot of references to your own string.
No, but an example of the fake string, if you have a string reference, and you want to write that to a file asynchronously.
Yes.
Presumably that has to last until that async call is done, or it might happen.
No, it only needs to last for the duration of the call. Because if this async operation needs to carry the data over another thread, and this is kind of WinRT guts, will create grab another thread from the thread pool, and will do a duplication of the H string, that will realize that this is a string reference rather than a regular string, and will actually do a copy. So under some circumstances, you don't get the benefit of saving a copy in the end. WinRT will still do the copy just to be safe, and then we'll follow reference counting rules. So it's a one-off thing that only for a call you can save a copy. As you go to async, copies will be made to the data. Does that answer?
I was hoping it would save the copy at all.
Yes, it doesn't. But I mean, if you already have a string hat, this is what happens. There is no copy of it.
So to be sure, use a string hat.
If you use a string hat to start with, then yeah, you save a copy. But it's not always practical, right? All right, so a quick thing, what I have here is a console app. It's less known that WinRT actually works in the outside the Windows Store environment as well. I do want to call out that its use is limited specifically to the WinRT APIs that are shipping with Windows, so you wouldn't be able to author your own WinRT types in this environment. But you can consume a lot of the WinRT APIs, and there are actually WinRT APIs that are available only for desktop. If you look at the documentation, there is a way to tell whether an API is available on both the Windows Store environment and on desktop. In this case, what I'm doing is, and for C++ CX, it's easy to configure a console app to actually take the new switches that we added, ZW, and you need to configure a few paths to get to the platform WinMD and to the Windows.WinMD files. And once you're there, you're ready to compile code that runs on the desktop. And what I have here is the main function. And there are two ways of writing the main function. Of course, there's a standard compliant way. And then there's this approach here that will automatically initialize the thread for you. One thing that you always have to do in WinRT is to initialize the thread so that you can create any components on it. And this is the main thread that gets initialized. And if you'd write a standard compliant entry point, you need to specify an attribute that tells what type of the initialization, whether it's MTA or STA, STA being the kind of the UI thread. So what I do here, I call this method readFile using DataReader, and this is the same code we looked at it earlier, with opening async, loading async, and then reading the data and displaying it on the screen, really simple. Let's see it run. So that's the message from the file that I read. If you're a Fringe fan, you know what I'm talking about. So I'm going to scroll down back to this code where it actually reads the data. And basically what happens here is that once you open the stream, you create a data reader helper to read the data for you from the file. And this data gets carried over into the memory. And then in the lines that I have selected, they get copied again into your own buffer. So what we're trying here to achieve is to save a copy here, save the double copy that we're actually getting using DataReader. It's not bad to use DataReader. It actually simplifies things a lot. But here's how you would do it to save one single copy. And that's important in scenarios where maybe you have loads of data that you need to read. It may not be relevant for some scenarios. So I will remove this data reader that it's shared across two actually, let me make this bigger. So this is shared across two continuations, and I don't need it anymore. This is a nice trick to share data across multiple lambdas in continuations. Just use a shared pointer of a hat, such that the ownership of the hat is shared. And when the SharePointer goes out of scope, gets to zero, the hat gets released. So you get a release call, and it may get destroyed. But this time around, I'm going to remove the data reader and start from here. So instead of that, call input streamer, read async. And it's probably really small, but you can see that this takes an iBuffer and the count of buffers that you need to read. So to get to a buffer, we need to create one. And the size would really be the size of the stream. We pass on the buffer. And for brevity, we're going to read it all. And now we're going to return this async operation. And I get a squiggle that says, it doesn't say anything. Let's see. I'm sure I got something wrong here, but I cannot point my finger to it. What? So I did specify the return. Oh, that's inferred from the code. It's actually an extension that we added to the standard. You can have as many lines as you can. As long as there is a lot of flow control in it, we're going to detect the signature of the lambda. I'm sure I'm going to find out what the problem here is soon enough. But one thing that we have to do here is, since we're returning a different async operation that we did before, the signature of the continuation in the next line will change. So one way of figuring out what the signature of this is by looking at the first parameter of the return value. So it's an async operation with progress of ibuffer. So this is our signature. Oh, yes. I remember from rehearsing this demo. I don't know. Thank you. Actually, yeah, that's the reason why I forgot, because there's nothing to say here. So I get an ibuffer, and now we need to get to the data. So what I did here, I pre-allocated the buffer, and the stream will write directly into my buffer that I allocated. And then I'm going to grab the data from it, the already allocated data. So I'm saving the copy. But how are we going to do that? Well, it cannot be easy, right? So I'm going to need to add a few includes. And probably I want to stop debugging. So one include that I need to add is rowBuffer.h, which I'll open it really quick. And we'll see that it has a definition of ibuffer byte access, that it's an interface that gets implemented for every ibuffer. Each time you have an ibuffer, you can query interface for the ibuffer byte access. The challenge with this is that this is COM API, COM interface. So how are we going to get to the to do query interface? First, we need to drop to the ABI definition of ibuffer. And then we're going to call query interface. So we're going to do that by including the headers that are shipping from Windows SDK that have the ABI definition of the same interface. So basically, it'll be in the same, we're going to look at the namespace of ibuffer, and it's Windows Storage Streams. So that's the header that I want. And because I'm going to be dealing with COM interfaces, I definitely don't want to use raw pointers. So we're going to bring WRL. And now, every ABI interface, it's hidden in the ABI namespace, so that they don't collide in the type name with a high-level interface that is used for hats. So I'll just go in and type this long, streams, ibuffer. This is my buffer. And then I'll need a comparator of the ibuffer byte access as well. Oh, and here I know what the problem is. Using namespace Microsoft WRL. All right. So now I'm going to cast from our high-level interface to the low-level interface. Because they are the exact same type, I can just reinterpret cast. It's not something that I recommend often doing. But in this case, C++ CX makes sure that specifically for interfaces, we do match the layout. So it's an ibuffer star. All right. And then we're going to call QI, query interface, and we're going to do it in the style of WRL. So I'm going to do just that. This returns an H result. So as I mentioned in the talk previously, I don't want to deal with that. Throw if failed. I immediately turn it into exceptions, and let me selected here to show you the code. It's basically the code that I had on the slides previously. And now I have a pbuffer access, so I will just call buffer, which just gives me a byte star star. So let's write p. And then let's write the size as well. Count. Well, the count would be buffer size length. And I'm going to pass the pointer such that it points directly inside the buffer. There is no copy here. And again, this is throwing throw if failed. OK, so now I populated this. Lifetime management is taken care of here by Competer. Actually, I should have mentioned here that I'm reinterpreting cast to an iBuffer star. But when I'm assigning into Competer, Competer will do an add ref. And then as it goes out of scope, it will release. So if I should just run this code, I have errors. I did miss a strings, yes. I should have probably make up a much shorter namespace and duplicate that. Does it work now? Looks like it compiled. Oh, I forgot to call it. Read file using L. I should probably also for declare it. Oh, no, I just changed it in place. What am I talking about? So please rename in your minds the method to be iBuffer. Okay. It already worked. But yeah. Okay, I'll switch back to the slides. This is how you save a copy. There is some work to do, right? But for specific scenarios, it may be worth it. So let's wrap up the things that I want to talk about. Really quick, if there's something that, if there's a session that I could persuade you to go, there would be Herb's session on Friday. If you care about C++, there's going to be, I took a pick of his slides, and there's a lot of things that he's going to be talking with you about. There's definitely going to be a lot of curly braces as well. So it should be a very entertaining talk. If there are four talks that I could persuade you to go, would be this four. And really, another thing that we're looking is looking for feedback for IDE development. So you already missed the first chance to submit, but if you have some time tomorrow, on Thursday between 3 and 6, please find the time to go and kind of share any feedback that you have about the IDE experience of developing and writing Windows Store apps, or in general about the experience of writing C++ apps. And if you don't have time, no reason not to sign up for future chances of giving us feedback. So with that, I want to really thank you for coming so late today, and hope you have a great evening. And I'll still be around for questions if you have any.